Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper for the week of Sunday, August 28th, 2022. I'll begin with local news and then move on to state news. We'll have a few sports articles as well. Nothing Bundt Cakes, celebrating 25 years with free Bundt Cakes, by Rosanna Frere, published August 31st. Nothing Bundt Cakes is celebrating its 25th birthday by giving customers a free confetti buntlet on Thursday, September 1st, according to a news release. The first 250 guests at each bakery will receive the free treat. The San Angelo Bakery is at 3204 Sherwood Way. The bakery is also holding an online contest where one fan will win a $25,000 birthday party planned by a celebrity party planning company. Additionally, 25 runners-up will each receive a $100 Nothing Bundt Cakes gift card. People can enter the contest by submitting a photo from their favorite birthday memory, describing what they enjoyed about it, and sharing what winning the party would mean to them. To enter and for contest rules, go online to nothingbundtcakes.com/25th-birthday. Entries will be accepted September 1st through the 25th, and winners will be announced on the contest website in October. San Angelo Coffee Shop to Close in September, by Rosanna Frere, published August 25th. A San Angelo coffee shop is closing soon, but is looking for a buyer to purchase the operation. The Grind Brew and Cafe, 220A North Chadron Street, opened in early March 2020. The business announced on its Facebook page that they would be saying goodbye to the shop. "It's been a fun and wild ride. As much as we love our coffee shop, it's time to say goodbye," the post stated. "It's important to have a good work-life balance, and unfortunately, at this time, and for quite some time, our beloved coffee shop hasn't been on our priority list." In the post, they said they would be willing to sell the business at a really great price, with the building excluded. If a buyer doesn't turn up, they will begin selling their almost new equipment. "If a coffee shop isn't in your future, we are renting the building and are open to making changes to the space to accommodate a new renter with an appropriate lease agreement," according to the post. "Thank you again, everyone. We had a blast, and we would totally do this again once we are retired." The last day of operation will be Friday, September 16th. Manny's Birthday Bash to benefit Angelo State Baseball, from Staff Reports, published September 1st. Manny's Birthday Bash at the house of Fifi Dubois on Saturday night will benefit the Angelo State University baseball team. The event runs from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., and tickets are $15 apiece. The Manny Compost Band, that also features Jimmy Shanks, Andrew Barrett, and Danan Barrett, will be the house band. There will be guest performances by Skeet Wilbanks, Noah Babb, and Kyler Dean. The house of Fifi Dubois is located at 123 South Chadron Street in downtown San Angelo. The ASU baseball team finished 51-14 overall last season. After winning the Lone Star Conference, NCAA Division II, South Central, Regional, and Super Regional tournament titles, the Rams advanced to the Division II College World Series for the fifth time overall and second straight time under longtime head coach Kevin Brooks. San Angelo ISD to begin after-school bus transportation for high school students, from Staff Reports, published August 30th. San Angelo ISD will begin its after-school bus transportation for high school students on Tuesday, September 6th, after the Labor Day holiday, according to a news release from the school district. The announcement comes 3 weeks after SAISD stated it was experiencing an unprecedented bus driver shortage and increased student ridership. The school district said it would continue to release updates as it worked to resolve the shortage. The bus transportation is for grades 9 through 12 at Central High School, the Central High School Oaks campus, and Lakeview High School. There will be no change to elementary and middle school bus routes, which we continue to provide both morning and afternoon transportation, the release stated. Thank you for understanding and cooperation as we work through this challenge. Law enforcement activity triggers shelter protocol at Erion County ISD, from staff reports published August 30th. An incident at the Erion County Sheriff's Office in Mertzon on Monday triggered a lockdown at the Erion County ISD campus, according to school officials. The school district alerted the public about noon Monday with the following Facebook post. At a little after 10 a.m., there were loud noises heard near the school, sounding like very loud fireworks. Out of an abundance of caution, we secured in place shortly to find out more information. There was an incident near the sheriff's office, and there is still law enforcement presences there, and the incident is being investigated. We gave the all clear at the school moments ago. Superintendent Dr. Ray Despain confirmed Tuesday that the district's students were in a class change, and some of the students were outside in between buildings when they heard the loud sounds. The Erion County Sheriff's Office is located on the corner of West Sherwood Avenue and North First Street, about three blocks from the Erion County campus. The school initiated its shelter-in-place protocol and called the sheriff's office. They waited for further instruction from the sheriff's office before leaving lockdown after approximately 20 minutes, Despain said. Inquiries by the Standard Times to the Erion County Sheriff's Office were forwarded to the Department of Public Safety. Sergeant Justin Baker told the Standard Times that the case had been turned over to the Texas Rangers for investigation. Tom Green County jail records indicate one arrest by the Erion County Sheriff's Office on Monday, August 29th. Justin Michael Chappell was booked at 2:38 p.m. and charged with assault, causes bodily injury, family violence, possession, controlled substance, penalty group 1, 1B, 1 gram, less than 4 grams, and escape while arrested, confined felony. Records show that Chappell remains in custody as of Tuesday morning, and bonds have been set totaling $104,000. This is a developing story and will be updated. And now sports. Central Bobcats' comeback attempt falls short against Colleen Shoemaker, by Paul Harris, published August 27th. The San Angelo Central football team came up just short and a 31-24 season-opening loss against Colleen Shoemaker on Friday. The Bobcats rallied from a 24-10 halftime deficit to tie the game with 6:04 remaining, but Shoemaker responded with a game-winning touchdown drive and held on for the win at Leo Buckley Stadium in Colleen. Central had a chance to tie the game when it took over on its own 34 with 2:42 to play, but the Bobcats' drive stalled shortly after crossing midfield. Central will make its home debut Friday, September 2nd, against El Paso Montwood at San Angelo Stadium. It was an up-and-down performance for Central against Shoemaker. The Bobcats fell behind 6-0 and then scored on back-to-back drives for a 10-6 lead before the offense went cold for a big chunk of the game. It was Central's defense that sparked the comeback, stuffing Shoemaker on a 4th-and-1 to begin the second half. It seemed to wake Central's offense up as the Bobcats drove down the field and scored on a touchdown run by Tyree Brawley with 6:57 left in the third quarter. Central scored again when Aiden Barron broke through the middle for a 25-yard TD run with 6:04 to play in the final quarter. Central quarterback Tyler Hill threw a 26-yard TD pass to Jacob English for the Bobcats' first score midway through the first quarter. And they nearly connected again on their final drive for what could have been a breakaway TD, but English was unable to haul in the long pass. Chase Miller was perfect on 4 kicks for Central, knocking through 3 extra points and a 38-yard field goal that gave the Bobcats a 10-6 lead early in the second quarter. Central defensive back Luke Gould had a key interception for Central late in the third quarter, with Shoemaker threatening to take a 2-score lead. Hill completed 15 of 26 passes for 157 yards and 1 TD, and he threw a pick. He rushed the ball 8 times for 51 yards. Brawley carried 10 times for a team-high 54 yards and 1 score. English led the Bobcats receiving corps with 5 receptions on 90 yards and 1 TD. Jacob Gallegos had 4 for 31. Lakeview Chiefs finished strong for exciting win over La Mesa, by Charles Bryce, published August 27th. The Lakeview High School football team came on strong late in the second half en route to a 42-28 non-district win against La Mesa in the season opener for both teams Friday night at San Angelo Stadium. Lakeview, 1-0, will travel to Sweetwater next Friday. La Mesa, which beat Lakeview 26-20 at home in last year's opener, dropped 0-2. "That's what they're made of," Lakeview head coach Hector Guevara said. "Our kids, they're resilient. They knew some kids were struggling, and all you hear is, we've got your back. You've got our back. And that's what they believe in. They're going to fight for each other, and it showed tonight." La Mesa led 14-12 at the half, but the Chiefs took their first lead on a 63-yard touchdown pass from quarterback Bryce Medley to Derek Taylor with 8:10 left in the third quarter. A two-point conversion run by Ian Cortez made it 20-14 Lakeview. The Chiefs stretched their lead to 28-14 on a 9-yard TD run by Ricky Ramirez with 10:34 left in the fourth. He also ran for the two-point conversion. The Golden Tornadoes answered with a pair of TDs to pull even at 28-28 with 6:42 left in regulation. Guevara had faith in his players when things could have gone either way in the fourth quarter. "We had to reassess where we're at and just execute," the Chiefs coach said. "Our kids were playing really well. We just had some bad moments out here and there. But we had some stalled drives and some turnovers, but the kids did good and they're resilient." After the Tours and the Chiefs traded interceptions, Lakeview took a 36-28 advantage with 1:48 remaining on a 16-yard TD run by Cortez, capped off by a two-point conversion run by Elijah Stone. La Mesa took over with 1:42 left, and two plays later, Lakeview defensive back Adrian Flores sealed the win with a 35-yard pick, 6 for the final margin. "He told me right before we broke the huddle, 'Coach, I got this.' And he sure did," Guevara said of Flores. Ramirez said the Chiefs weren't going to be denied. "We wanted it when we first came on the field," Ramirez said. "And when things started getting tough, we just wanted it even more. And that's what kind of drove us to really come out on fire in that second half." And as for Flores's pick six that finished things off, Ramirez couldn't have been prouder of his teammate. "I was amazed," Ramirez said. "He and I are close. I call him my little seed, my little offspring. I was so excited for him." La Mesa was up 6-0 heading into the second quarter before Medley connected with Devashian Manley, a bruising 6'1", 225-pound wide receiver, for a 45-yard TD strike at the 11:46 mark of the first quarter to even the contest at 6-6. The conversion kick failed. In his first career start at quarterback, Medley completed 8 of 22 passes for 207 yards and 2 TDs. He was picked off twice. He also carried 14 times for 50 yards and 1 TD. Ramirez was the Chiefs' top rusher with 13 carries for 96 yards and 1 TD. Cortez had 9 carries for 53 yards and a TD. Manley led Lakeview's receiving corps with 4 receptions for 82 yards and 1 TD. Tom Green County Library System, now fine-free. Here's What You Need to Know, by Rosanna Frere, published August 25th. On Tuesday, the Tom Green County Commissioner's Court voted to make the county's library system fine-free. Here's what you need to know about the new policy. Director Jill Donegan proposed the consideration the morning of Tuesday, August 23rd, and received board approval. "It went into effect around noon Tuesday and applies to all materials," said Amy Dennis, the county's public relations librarian. "The new policy is forthcoming and will be available for patrons this week at tgclibrary.com or in print at either West Branch or Stevens Central." The library answered some frequently asked questions on its website. Why are you getting rid of overdue fines? Over the last 2 decades, public libraries have come to recognize fines as a barrier to access. By definition, library fines are regressive in the sense that they disproportionately impact those who are least able to pay them. Simply put, public libraries believe that no one should be denied access to the library or its collection because of an inability to pay. Most larger libraries in Texas are now fine-free as well, including our friends in Midland, Abilene, and Alpine. We agree that it simply isn't fair to continue nickel to nickel and dime our patrons. Won't the library suffer financially as a result? The cost of assessing, maintaining, and collecting overdue fines largely outweighs any revenue generated by them. Does this mean I can keep a book or other item for as long as I want? No, standard due dates still apply. Library users will still be charged replacement costs for items that are lost or damaged. If an item is not returned or renewed within 28 days of the due date, the item will be considered lost and a replacement charge will be added to that user's library account. That user will be blocked from checking out additional items until the charges are paid or the items are returned. What types of charges may still be incurred on my library account? If an item is overdue for 28 days, it will be considered lost and a replacement cost will be charged to your account. Additionally, if an item is damaged or a part is missing from an item when it is returned, you may still be charged for the item. How long will it take for charges to be taken off of my account? Library staff are working hard to waive existing fines accrued at our library as quickly as possible. We appreciate everyone's patience. If the overdue fines on your account are preventing you from using the library, give us a call at 325-655-7321, and we'll be happy to take care of those charges. I always thought of fines as a way to support the library. How do I continue to support the library if not through fines? We welcome your continued support. As always, the library relies on gifts and donations to purchase additional materials and fund programs for all ages. Donations to the library or to the Friends of the Library group can be mailed to the library to the attention of Director Jill Donegan, Tom Green County Library, 33 West Beauregard Avenue, San Angelo, Texas, 76903. For more information, call 325-655-7321. State news. Less groundwater and more demand. Can Texas quench its thirst? By Hogan Gore, Austin American Statesman, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, August 30th. Leaving a mess of sludge, a nearly 900-foot hole in the ground, and a bill north of $40,000, the groundwater well Mike Heck drilled on his property in Williamson County this month did not come with a guarantee. But after the pump he relied on for more than a decade unexpectedly quit delivering water to his home from the Trinity Aquifer in July, Heck had limited options to secure a new water source. Once the drilling for the new well was complete, the answer as to why the water had stopped flowing became clear. The aquifer's water level had dropped by roughly 200 feet underneath Heck's property. I knew that the pump might fail. That's what I sort of expected. As far as the well to go dry, no, I didn't see that coming, Heck said. Now all I think about is getting water to my house. More of a bellwether than an outlier, Heck's situation is emblematic of the increasing concern Texans face in securing access to water amid a struggle with overpumping, regulatory underfunding, a population boom, and a current drought rivaling the state's worst. And though the drought that ran from 1950 to 1957 remains as the record, and a drought beginning in 2011 set new standards as the driest and hottest consecutive 12-month period in state history, according to the Texas Water Development Board, the current drought has been compared to both. According to the latest data from the U.S. Drought Monitor released Thursday, about 95% of the state is under drought conditions, with more than half experiencing extreme or exceptional drought. With multiple factors contributing to an overall loss of groundwater, well owners across Texas also find themselves under different rules and mandates from one county to the next, as the political bodies charged with local oversight of aquifers, groundwater conservation districts, are optional. In Williamson County, which lacks a groundwater conservation district, well owners experiencing drawdowns are hard-pressed to find reasons the water has stopped flowing. That's one of those areas where the average individual has no real way to understand what's happening in the ground underneath him and no one to really call, said Gary Rimes, whose property abuts Hex on Buck Bend Road west of Georgetown. Thankfully to Hex, Rimes' previous water well issues that resulted in him installing an above-ground water storage tank meant the two were able to run hundreds of feet of hose, connecting Heck to an alternative supply as he waited for water deliveries and an available driller to install the new well. Meanwhile, across the county line, the Clearwater Underground Water Conservation District in Bell County has been keeping tabs on the region's groundwater supply. With unceasing well permit requests, incoming housing developments, and unlimited pumping to the district's south, data from one of the state's leading groundwater authorities show water levels in the Trinity Aquifer to be in constant decline. Whether they were pumping real heavy or not, the regional drawdown because of so many wells is about 12 feet per year, said Dirk Aaron, general manager of the Clearwater District. According to Aaron, the district has about 4,000 active residential wells, and while the district conducted a study showing that a family of four can operate on 300 gallons a day, many individual users in the region are outpacing that number by 17,000 gallons daily. As a result, and coupled with the dry heat bringing conditions second only to the 2011 drought in state history, more and more well owners are having to dig deeper to source water. And it isn't stopping. It's exactly what we experienced in 2011, 2012, and 2013, Aaron said of constantly fielding permits for lowering pumps and drilling new wells. U.S. Drought Monitor data show regions across the state experiencing extreme or exceptional drought declined from 61% to 43% and 26% to 12% respectively in the past week, thanks to recent rains. And though that precipitation did slightly alleviate the severity of the state's drought conditions, the effect on aquifer water levels will be limited in the Trinity as only 4 to 5% of rainfall ends up recharging it. With that in mind, Aaron is most concerned with continuing to develop the science and ability to accurately depict the region's water outlook, as well as convey the importance of conservation to the area's hundreds of thousands of new residents. Population growth over the last decade has affected the whole of Texas, but of the nearly 4 million people who have moved to the state since 2010, many have settled throughout the Central Hill Country. Bell, Bastrop, Travis, Hayes, and Williamson counties all had sizable population increases from 2010 to 2020, ranging from 20% to more than 40%, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. In Williamson County, a 44% population jump to 609,000 residents transformed once rural areas into multiple housing developments with large homes, nearly all reliant on groundwater sourced from the Trinity and Edwards aquifers. It's not necessarily that the population has grown, but the population, the new culture, the new people moving here, do not have an understanding of water conservation like the Texan of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, Aaron said. And at the same time, many groundwater conservation districts lack the funding needed for science capable of identifying the best local solutions to help with water sustainability. Additionally, the 101 districts across the state directly responsible for looking after aquifer conditions do so at the hyperlocal level. In some ways, it's sort of a Byzantine system, because the aquifers that we manage run from the Arkansas border all the way down to Mexico, and yet we're chopped up and regulating based on political boundaries, said Jim Toten, general manager of the Lost Pines Groundwater Conservation District covering Bastrop and Lee counties. There is a real benefit, however, to maintaining localized control, Toten said, as the characteristics of aquifers and surrounding environmental factors vary greatly from region to region. Coordination and communication are also common among the districts, as they are heavily involved in creating the state's water plan every 5 years, in coordination with 16 regional planning groups that are organized to provide a broader and more comprehensive view of groundwater impact. Through that inventory process, outlining the state's groundwater supply, anticipated future water needs and the conditions necessary to meet them, many conservation districts are forced to pick and choose how they will fight aquifer degradation, as districts are totally reliant on ad valorem taxes, permit fees, and grants to finance both operations and data collection. Even though the state requires groundwater districts to meet and develop these planning goals, desired future conditions, they don't provide any funding for districts to do that, said Vanessa Puig-Williams and director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Texas Water Program. I would describe it as an unfunded mandate. Not very well funded. The Texas House Committee on Natural Resources has prioritized during the legislative interim the groundwater conservation district's well-being and availability of resources. A number of those groundwater districts are candidly not very well funded, said Representative Tracy King, Democrat Laredo, the committee's chair. They need a source of revenue in order to do the proper scientific studies so they can evaluate these permits and be fair to everyone involved. Additionally, the question of how to sustainably handle the state's dependence on groundwater, as some areas remain locally unregulated, continues to remain an issue. Areas where there is groundwater, but there is no district, generally speaking, we're unable to get the level of support to create it, King said. They either don't want to pay those taxes, or they just don't want the government telling them how much water they can use. The Natural Resources Committee, charged with a host of obligations related to Texas's water, is also keen to learn more on the effects of large water transfer projects, such as the Vista Ridge Project. The project, with a pipeline delivering groundwater from Lee County to San Antonio, has resulted in aquifer-level declines throughout the area, said Totten, the Lost Pines District's general manager. In September, Totten expects to receive data outlining the effects of the current drought, but he anticipates a continued emphasis on the water moving to San Antonio. Most of our monitoring right now is really currently focused on the impacts we're seeing coming across from the Vista Ridge Project, he said. By 2070, water demand in the state is expected to require an additional 1.6 million acre feet per year when compared with today, according to the 2022 Texas State Water Plan. Over the same time, groundwater levels are projected to decline by 2.9 million acre feet. For Aaron, the general manager of the Clearwater District in Bell County, the current groundwater conditions and the future outlook are proof that conservation efforts such as fixing water infrastructure and leak detection, having less concern with landscaping optics, and an awareness that water is a valuable resource could make a real difference. I firmly believe it's never too late, Aaron said, but the amount of water that people are using, they're just consuming like it's a promise, it's a guarantee. $132 million in Permian Basin oil and gas assets bought by Texas company. Region's growth picks up. By Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus, published August 30th in the San Angelo Standard-Times. An oil and gas company based in Austin, Texas, sought to strengthen its Permian Basin presence, spending $132.5 million on lands and facilities already operated in the region. Brigham Minerals announced August 22nd it planned to purchase the assets from Avant Natural Resources, including about 3,900 acres in the Eastern Midland Sub-Basin, with 233 wells expected to be developed in the next year in Midland and Martin counties. The lands will be developed by major operators in the region, Pioneer Natural Resources, ExxonMobil, and Endeavor Energy Resources. Next year, the acquisition was expected to produce 750 to 950 barrels of oil equivalent per day at about 60% oil per the announcement. Brigham Chief Executive Officer Robert Ruza said the transaction continued the company's efforts to consolidate oil and gas assets in the region, the U.S.'s busiest onshore oil production region, and generate partnerships with some of the world's largest energy companies. Our continued success consolidating core minerals is clearly demonstrated by our largest acquisition to date, Ruza said. I personally view this acquisition as the highest quality Midland Basin package we've evaluated to date, given both the diversification across two of the most prolific geologic counties in the lower 48 and the high-quality operator composition. Brigham's acquisition was followed by the August 24th closure of a Permian Basin-focused merger of an oil and gas midstream company as Diamondback Energy bought out and absorbed the subsidiary, Rattler Midstream, in a deal that analysts valued at about $575 million. The deal meant Diamondback acquired all of Rattler's assets not already owned by the parent company, and the subsidiary would no longer be listed as a publicly traded company. Diamondback CEO Travis Stice said the merger was warranted following the COVID-19 pandemic that stymied fuel demand and led to a plummet of oil prices below $0 a barrel for the first time in history. Since the pandemic and amid the market's recovery, energy companies sought to consolidate their assets, focusing on transactions on existing resources and mergers. The energy landscape has transformed dramatically since Rattler was taken public in 2019, and we believe this agreement to merge companies is in the best interests of both Diamondback and Rattler stakeholders, Stice said when the Diamond-Rattler merger was announced in May. This merger will allow both companies to benefit from the simplicity and scale of the combined entity going forward. Increased market activity followed a heightened oil price environment as the price per barrel of domestic crude climbed above pre-pandemic levels, spending the spring and summer in the triple digits and dropping slightly in recent weeks on fears of COVID-19 resurgence and increased supply. The price of oil was $95 a barrel as of Monday, per the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, marking a climb from the lowest price of the summer, $86 a barrel, reported August 16th. Higher prices meant more drilling for oil and gas throughout the Permian Basin and increased the need to manage the resulting wastewater known as produced water in the industry. Such water is brought to the surface with crude and natural gas, high in brine and chemicals, and toxic for human consumption. Traditionally, produced water was pumped back underground into rock formations from where it came from, and recently was treated for reuse in subsequent extraction operations. Either way, the water needs to be moved from where it is produced to where it is disposed of, and increased fossil fuel operations in the Permian Basin brought growth in infrastructure to handle the wastewater. Palisades Pipeline announced an open season for its Rail Runner produced water gathering system in the northern Delaware subbasin on the western side of the Permian, allowing operators to reserve capacity for wastewater generated during operations. The system will transport water from the Delaware Basin, one of the Permian's most active regions, to saltwater disposal wells and reuse facilities in Winkler County, Texas. The pipeline moves water about 97 miles for disposal or recycling, with an approved capacity of 500,000 barrels per day from Lovington to Monahans, Texas. The line presently had a capacity of about 150,000 barrels per day, but will be expanded as it goes into service. Why the Texas grid causes the High Plains to turn off its wind turbines. Jamie Lozano, the Texas Tribune, published August 30th in the San Angelo Standard-Times, Lubbock. The state's High Plains region, which covers 41 counties in the Texas Panhandle and West Texas, is home to more than 11,000 wind turbines, the most in any area of the state. The region could generate enough wind energy to power at least 9 million homes. Experts say the additional energy could help provide much-needed stability to the electric grid during high-energy demand summers like this one, and even lower the power bills of Texans and other parts of the state. But a significant portion of the electricity produced in the High Plains stays there for a simple reason. It can't be moved elsewhere. Despite the growing development of wind energy production in Texas, the state's transmission network would need significant infrastructure upgrades to ship out the energy produced in the region. We're at a moment when wind is at its peak production profile, but we see a lot of wind energy being curtailed or congested and not able to flow through some of the higher population areas, said John Hensley, vice president for research and analytics at the American Clean Power Association, which is a loss for ratepayers and a loss for those energy consumers that now have to either face conserving energy or paying more for the energy they do use because they don't have access to that lower cost wind resource. And when the rest of the state is asked to conserve energy to help stabilize the grid, the High Plains has to turn off turbines to limit wind production it doesn't need. Because there's not enough transmission to move it where it's needed, ERCOT has to throttle back the wind generators, energy lawyer Michael Jewell said. They actually tell the wind generators to stop generating electricity. It gets to the point where wind farm operators literally have to disengage the generators entirely and stop them from doing anything. Texans have already had a few energy scares this year amid scorching temperatures and high energy demand to keep homes cool. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which operates the state's electrical grid, warned about drops in energy production twice last month and asked people across the state to lower their consumption to avoid an electricity emergency. The energy supply issues have hit Texans' wallets as well. Nearly half of Texas's electricity is generated at power plants that run on the state's most dominant energy source, natural gas, and its price has increased more than 200% since late February, causing elevated home utility bills. Meanwhile, wind farms across the state account for nearly 21% of the state's power generation. Combined with wind generation near the Gulf of Mexico, Texas produced more than one-fourth of the nation's wind-powered electric generation last year. Wind energy is one of the lowest-priced energy sources because it is sold at fixed prices. Turbines do not need fuel to run, and the federal government provides subsidies. Texans who get their energy from wind farms in the High Plains region usually pay less for electricity than people in other areas of the state. But with the price of natural gas increasing from inflation, Jewell said areas where wind energy is not accessible have to depend on electricity that costs more. Other generation sources are more expensive than what customers would have gotten from the wind generators if they could move it, Jewell said. That is the definition of transmission congestion, because you can't move the cheaper electricity through the grid. A 2021 ERCOT report shows that there have been increases in stability constraints for wind energy in recent years in both West and South Texas that have limited the long-distance transfer of power. The transmission constraints are such that energy can't make it to the load centers. High Plains wind power might be able to make it to Lubbock, but it might not be able to make it to Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, or Austin, Jewell said. This is not an insignificant problem. It is costing Texans a lot of money. Some wind farms in the High Plains foresaw there would be a need for transmission. The Trent wind farm was one of the first in the region. Beginning operations in 2001, the wind farm is between Abilene and Sweetwater in West Texas and has about 100 wind turbines, which can supply power to 35,000 homes. Energy company American Electric Power built the site near a power transmission network and built a short transmission line, so the power generated there does go into the ERCOT system. But Jewell said high energy demand and costs this summer show there's a need to build additional transmission lines to move more wind energy produced in the High Plains to other areas of the state. Jewell said the Public Utility Commission, which oversees the grid, is conducting tests to determine the economic benefits of adding transmission lines from the High Plains to the more than 52,000 miles of lines that already connect to the grid across the state. As of now, however, there is no official proposal to build new lines. It does take a lot of time to figure it out. You're talking about a transmission line that's going to be in service for 40 or 50 years, and it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, Jewell said. You want to be sure that the savings outweigh the costs, so it's a longer process. But we need more transmission in order to be able to move more energy. This state is growing by leaps and bounds. A report by the American Society of Civil Engineers released after the February 2021 windstorm stated that Texas has substantial and growing reliability and resilience problems with its electric system. The report concluded that failures that caused overwhelming human and economic suffering during February will increase in frequency and duration due to legacy market design shortcomings, growing infrastructure interdependence, economic and population growth drivers, and aging equipment, even if the frequency and severity of weather events remains unchanged. The report also stated that while transmission upgrades across the state have generally been made in a timely manner, it's been challenging to add infrastructure where there has been rapid growth, like in the High Plains. Despite some Texas lawmakers' vocal opposition against wind and other forms of renewable energy, the state has prime real estate for harnessing wind power because of its open plains, and farmers can put turbines on their land for financial relief. This has led to a boom in wind farms, even with transmission issues. Since 2010, wind energy generation in Texas has increased by 15%. This month, the Biden administration announced the Gulf of Mexico's first offshore wind farms will be developed off the coasts of Texas and Louisiana and will produce enough energy to power around 3 million homes. Texas really does sort of stand head and shoulders above all other states when it comes to the actual amount of wind, solar, and battery storage projects that are on the system, Hensley said. One of the issues often brought up with wind and solar farms is that they may not be able to produce as much energy as the state needs all the time. Earlier this month, when ERCOT asked consumers to conserve electricity, the agency listed low wind generation and cloud coverage in West Texas as factors contributing to a tight energy supply. Hensley said this is where battery storage stations can help. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, utility-scale batteries tripled in capacity in 2021 and can now store up to 4.6 gigawatts of energy. Texas has been quickly developing storage projects. In 2011, Texas had only 5 megawatts of battery storage capacity. By 2020, that had ballooned to 323.1 megawatts. Storage is the real game changer because it can help to mediate and control a lot of the intermittency issues that a lot of folks worry about when they think about wind and solar technology, Hensley said. So being able to capture a lot of that solar that comes right around noon to 1 p.m. and move it to those evening periods when demand is at its highest, or even move strong wind resources from overnight to the early morning or afternoon hours. Storage technology can help, but Hensley said transmission is still the big factor to consider. Solar is another resource that can help stabilize the grid. According to the Solar Energy Industries Association, Texas has about 13,947 megawatts of solar installed and more than 161,000 installations. That's enough to power more than 1.6 million homes. This year, the PUC formed a task force to develop a pilot program next year that would create a pathway for solar panels and batteries on small-scale systems like homes and businesses to add that energy to the grid. The program would make solar and batteries more accessible and affordable for customers, and it would pay customers to share their stored energy to the grid as well. Hensley said Texas has the most clean energy projects in the works that will likely continue to put the region above the rest when it comes to wind generation. So they're already ahead, and it looks like they're going to be even further ahead 6 months or a year down the road, he said. Are abortion and Uvalde changing the game in the Texas governor's race? Even though many of the issues appear to cut into Beto O'Rourke's favor, polling shows he's not cutting into Governor Abbott's advantage. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, August 21st. Austin. When a statewide poll released in mid-May showed that Democrat Beto O'Rourke had carved Governor Greg Abbott's once commanding double-digit lead down to just 7 percentage points, it gave the challenger's campaign a jolt of badly needed energy. And since then, events outside the control of either candidate have thrust issues in O'Rourke's wheelhouse onto the front burner. The horrific May 24th massacre at Uvalde's Robb Elementary School all but muted criticism of his famous Hell Yes promise to take away privately owned assault rifles. And it provided him a platform to hammer Abbott for doing virtually nothing to limit the availability of those rifles, even though at least a half dozen deadly mass shootings had been carried out on the governor's watch. Exactly 1 month after Uvalde, which had put Abbott on the defensive as details about the botched law enforcement response first trickled, then cascaded into public view, came the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that struck down Roe v. Wade, the landmark case that for 49 years made abortion a constitutional right. All indications in the days and weeks after the court's action suggested it would accrue to the benefits of candidates such as O'Rourke, who were vocal champions of reproductive freedom. But in the 3 months since the Dallas Morning News and the University of Texas at Tyler released their poll, there has been almost zero movement in the horse race numbers. In May, 46% of respondents said they preferred Abbott and 39% planned to vote for O'Rourke. Those same percentages held in an August 14th survey. Digging into Abbott O'Rourke's numbers. Deeper dives into both polls' internal data also show a rock-steady political landscape in Texas. The numbers are largely unchanged when it comes to voter attitudes on Abbott and O'Rourke. Of those who stated an opinion, about half like each and about half don't. Each candidate has a solid lock on his party's base. If O'Rourke was looking for some good news, his side would tout that he leads among independent voters by about 3 percentage points. He was 10 points down among that bloc in May. Abbott's camp can take heart that, notwithstanding the abortion and gun issues that have framed much of the debate over the past 3 months, the governor has gained 4 points among female voters and O'Rourke has dropped 2. It's important to note that while the May and August polls both have a margin of error of just under 3 percentage points, that rate climbs exponentially higher when the figures from the sundry subgroups are tallied. Questions on race, on issues such as abortion and gun violence, were put to all of the respondents in the August poll, and the answers appeared to cut in O'Rourke's favor. A full 63% said leaders currently holding elective office are not doing enough to curb mass shootings. And 55% said abortion should be legal in at least most cases, despite the high court's ruling and despite the Abbott-backed law passed in Texas that makes it illegal. Are any issues gaining traction in the Texas governor's race? But those issues have not provided the Democrat the traction he needs to carve into the incumbent's lead. Voters appear to be more persuaded by the issues Abbott has been hammering, immigration and the economy. Just over half in the August poll expressed overall support for the governor's hardline stance on border security, and nearly 8 in 10 approved of his controversial but short-lived commercial truck inspection order that shut down commerce at the ports of entry for days on end in the spring. And 53% said they like Abbott's approach to the economy, while the blame for inflation lands at the feet of the Democratic Biden administration. O'Rourke's side might take heart that 56% of the respondents said Texas is headed down the wrong track, which is a thin recommendation for Abbott's desire for a third term. But the right track, wrong track numbers haven't changed a lick since May, and neither has the governor's lead. By any measure, O'Rourke is the most energetic candidate so far. He's in the midst of a nonstop blitz that has carried him all over the state and in areas that have been decidedly unfriendly to Democrats for decades. But the stubborn numbers in the latest poll appear to suggest that no matter how hard he campaigns and no matter how many crowds he draws in Texas's red and purple pockets, the game changer that O'Rourke needs remains elusive down the home stretch to the November 8th election. John C. Moritz covers Texas government and politics for the USA Today Network in Austin. Why raising the criminal age to 18 could further strain Texas juvenile justice system. If 17-year-old offenders are placed in the juvenile justice system, the added strain would have a ripple effect on an already struggling agency, lawmakers were told. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, August 25th. Austin. Raising the age of criminal offenders sent to Texas prisons to 18 would likely increase opportunities for rehabilitation, but it would also further tax every level of a juvenile justice system that already cannot handle the number of young lawbreakers entering the pipeline in ever-increasing numbers, a legislative panel was told Wednesday. William Carter, the chief juvenile probation officer for a multi-county region anchored in Lubbock, said that statewide almost 54,000 young people entered the juvenile probation system in 2019. About 30% of them were for felony offenses, he said. That same year, more than 21,000 who were 17 were arrested statewide and under law were processed into the adult criminal justice system, Carter said. In a system that's struggling right now, do you think we can handle 40% more kids? Carter told the Special Texas House Committee studying criminal justice reforms ahead of next year's legislative session. I don't think so. Earlier this month, a separate committee was told that the Texas Juvenile Justice Department which is responsible for people aged 10 to 16 who commit felonies, is so short-staffed because of low salaries and high-stress working conditions that it cannot handle all of the offenders it's presently being sent. It's become so bad that sometimes the young offenders, many with moderate to severe mental illness, are kept in their rooms up to 23 hours a day. But only about 2% of all young offenders, generally considered the worst of the worst, are sent to one of the state's five youth lockups. Nearly all of the rest are the responsibility of the regional juvenile justice centers. State funding for those facilities has diminished in recent years, and the slack has been made up by county taxpayers, the committee was told. The Texas Center for Justice and Equity, a criminal justice reform nonprofit, said in a 2021 study that most 17-year-old offenders are jailed for low-level and nonviolent crimes. These kids could be processed through the juvenile system, where they would have more access to community-based rehabilitative services, such as counseling, education, and treatment, giving them positive and age-appropriate redirection, the study said. This is a common-sense approach, as kids are highly amenable to rehabilitation. State Representative Sinfronia Thompson, a Houston Democrat who has served in the House since 1973, said the dire financial straits facing juvenile justice programs have been a staple of her 50 years of legislative service. "We have underfunded your agency every session of the legislature since I've been here," Thompson told Chandra Carter, TJJD's interim director. Chandra Carter, who is not related to the regional chief probation officer, said that if 17-year-olds are placed in the juvenile system, which is the case in all but three states, including Texas, it would likely double the number of youth in state lockups. Carter told the committee her agency likely needs 9 additional facilities designed to handle about 74 offenders each so that staff could provide more personalized services such as education and mental health treatment. But she said she will likely limit that request because of the cost. State Representative Jeff Leach, a Plano Republican who chairs the special committee, said after the hearing that lawmakers cannot continue to shortchange TJJD, but lawmakers must allocate the money wisely, he said. "I think the political will is there, certainly on this committee," Leach said, "but it's not just funding, it's investing in what works." Leach said he and the other members of his committee in the coming weeks will likely visit at least one of the five state-run youth lockups as they prepare to make recommendations for the 2023 legislature on how to address the issues facing juvenile justice. Joe Evans, who acts as a mentor for young offenders in regional detention centers, told the panel that the state needs to develop programs aimed at rehabilitation almost from the moment of arrest. He made a reference to a 15-year-old who first entered the system after stealing a car for a joyride and is now on his third stint in custody for a more violent offense. "It starts off with a joyride in a stolen car," Evans said, "and next, it's a carjacking." And now here's the column from Allison Watkins. "It's finally time to make plans for fall lawn care in West Texas." Published August 26th. Some in the Concho Valley have been lucky to receive a bit of rain recently, but San Angelo is still pretty dry. We will keep hoping and praying, though. The days are getting shorter, and temperatures are going down bit by bit, and fall is thankfully on the way. It's time to make plans for fall lawn care to try and keep the turf grass healthy and strong so it goes through winter dormancy in good shape and greens up well into spring. First is the decision of whether or not to fertilize. Nitrogen fertilizer can be tough on plants that are heat and drought stressed, so don't fertilize unless you've been watering adequately to maintain active green grown, or wait until it rains and cools down a bit more. Either way, get it done by early October to not promote too much new growth too close to winter. There have been many questions lately regarding planting new grass. If starting from seed, late spring through early summer is the best window for planting warm season turf grass such as Bermuda. So now is not the recommended time. Cool season grasses, such as fescue and rye, are not generally recommended in the Concho Valley because they do not hold up well enough through the summer. Sod can be planted just about any time of year with careful care and attention, but it's best to get it planted in the spring or early fall to give it time to establish well and then go dormant before cold winter temperatures come along. If St. Augustine grass is struggling or there has been a history of take-all root rot disease causing large areas of the lawn to turn yellow and then die back, treat every fall and spring to reduce damage and prevent the fungal disease. If just starting to exhibit mild symptoms or to maintain healthy St. Augustine, top dress with 1 to 2 bales of Sphagan peat moss per 1,000 square feet and apply a micronutrient fertilizer containing manganese. If there are areas damaged by the disease, also treat with the turf fungicide containing azoxystrobin, such as Heritage or Scott's Disease X. Consider applying pre-emergent in healthy, well-established lawns to prevent cool seasonal annual weeds such as rescue grass and henbit. Wait until soil temperature cools down to about 70 degrees for several days before applying pre-emergent in the fall. That usually happens in the latter half of September or early October. For a more in-depth guide to applying pre-emergent for the lawn, visit https://tomgreen.agrilife.org/horticulture and click on pre-emergence herbicides. Read the label carefully and follow all directions for product rate and application instructions. Join us for the annual Fall Landscaping Symposium offered by the Concho Valley Master Gardeners on Saturday, September 10th. For info and to register, visit https://txmg.org/Concho Valley. There is a great lineup of speakers, including a session on lawn care. Don't miss out. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.